My guest at this time is former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. He is now with the American Enterprise Institute. He joins me now to offer his reaction to President Trump decertifying the Iran nuclear deal, what's ahead in the Middle East as the noose squeezes the life out of ISIS, and the state of U.S. diplomacy in general as we deal with multiple crises around the world. And Mr. Ambassador, it's always good to have you with us. Thank you.
Well, glad to be with you. Thanks for having me again.
Well, last week, President Trump, as a lot of people expected, announced that he was decertifying the Iran nuclear deal, talking about a number of different ways he believes the Iranians are in violation. You, of course, have been against the deal from the outset, and you've also said decertification is not enough. You want a full withdrawal from the agreement. So what do you make of Trump's decision, and why do you think it's not enough?
Well, I think the reason that the United States needs to withdraw entirely is to create a new reality, to strip away the camouflage that Iran is provided by this deal, where it gains resources from trade and investment deals from all over the world, but basically continues to pursue its nuclear weapons program without adequate inspection or verification. The Iranians have cooperated with North Korea in the past. Wouldn't surprise me if they're cooperating with them now. And the fact is, until the United States gets out and it's clear that no American companies are going to do business with Iran, and European companies are going to have to decide whether they want to do business with the Ayatollahs or with the United States, that we've got a chance of getting back on track here. So the president has adopted what he calls a two-stage approach. This basically gives Congress 60 days to see if they can come up with some kind of comprehensive strategy. I have no faith whatever that Congress will be able to do that. So I think in 60 days it'll be back to the president. And I'm hoping then that having given the supporters of the deal and the people who think the deal can be improved time to play out their option, and failing, that he'll then take the next step and get out of the deal entirely. I mean, it gives Iran 60 more days to continue to make progress towards a nuclear weapons capability, 60 days where we're not really leading toward a resolution that stops them from getting nuclear weapons. But it's certainly much better than recertifying that the deal's in America's national interest. What he did at least was to serve notice that it's not, and nobody should be under any illusions. We're still in the Obama administration.
Sir, to listen to the Democrats and most folks in the media, they're absolutely convinced, at least publicly, that the Iran nuclear deal is an ironclad guarantee against Iran developing a nuclear weapon, certainly in the next decade. And you've obviously explained to us many times over the last couple of years why you believe that's certainly not the case. But if we walk away and Iran does end up developing and deploying a nuclear weapon, is that ultimately going to be blamed on this president?
Look, they're developing a nuclear weapon now. The argument to stay in the deal is that somehow the deal is constraining them, and I believe that it's not. They gave up temporary, easily reversible concessions in exchange for hundreds of billions of dollars of trade and investment assets being unfrozen. You know, just about 2 months ago now, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said that if they made a decision themselves to withdraw from the deal, they could get back to pre-deal levels of uranium enrichment in 5 days. Now, you know, you take everything the Iranian leadership says with a big grain of salt, but in that case, they happen to be right, and it's an indication of just how minimal their concessions were. And that's only the concessions in areas that we know something about, where a nuclear facility was already known to us, already known to the International Atomic Energy Agency. And what frightens me is what's going on in locations that we don't know about. Every time the Iranians have made a disclosure about their nuclear program for the last 20 years, it's only been after U.S. intelligence uncovered it or Iranian opposition groups made it public. The Iranian regime has never disclosed anything material about its nuclear program voluntarily. And I'm afraid that that same pattern is being followed here. So, you know, if you believe that this deal is actually restraining Iran, maybe you'd like to talk about purchase of the Brooklyn Bridge, because that's about the level of credibility the deal has.
You've already laid this out a little bit already in our conversation, but if, in fact, Trump does end up scrapping this deal, what's the right policy moving forward? That seems to be the really elusive thing for the past three administrations now, is what to do to actually stop this from happening in terms of the deployment of a nuclear weapon.
Well, you're right, and that's why what Trump has inherited, and I might say he's inherited the same problem in the case of North Korea, is we are basically running out of time. After 25 years of trying to talk North Korea and Iran out of their nuclear weapons programs, they're both close to crossing the finish line. So if they weren't willing to give up their nuclear programs voluntarily before, who could possibly believe that being so close to final success, they'd give it up now? And so I think there's some very hard choices, and I think North Korea may be a little ahead of Iran in the sense of coming to that issue coming to a head first. But as I mentioned, I do think there's cooperation between North Korea and Iran. So coming back to your pertinent question about what constraints the Iran deal puts Iran under, you know, I think they could buy a nuclear device from North Korea tomorrow if they'd write out a check for the right amount of money. And that's why another mistake of the past 25 years has been treating the North Korean and Iranian threats separately, when in fact they're linked. So Trump's down to some very unattractive options, I've got to say, and I know people don't like to hear it, but you can't leave the military option off the table, because if you believe, as Trump said in his UN speech just about a month ago, that the only way forward with North Korea is denuclearization, and I think the same is true with Iran, that means we can't leave the current scenario with them still in possession of nuclear weapons, because otherwise they're available to extort and blackmail the United States as far as the eye can see.
Let's move on to another area very close to Iran, and that's Iraq and Syria. ISIS, as we have learned in recent days and even more today, ISIS is in tatters. It looks like the U.S.-backed militias have either taken most of Raqqa or all of it, depending on who you listen to. What does the speed of the ISIS demise tell us about the current policy towards ISIS versus the previous policy?
Well, I think the president's right to say that he significantly speeded up the end of the ISIS caliphate, and I think we are at the point where there may still be resistance here and there, but functionally the caliphate is over. That doesn't mean the ISIS threat is over, because many of its leaders exfiltrated from the region to Libya, to Yemen, to Afghanistan, to other places where terrorists can hole up and plan their terrorist attacks. So we still face the terrorist threat from ISIS, but the caliphate itself is gone, at least for the moment. The problem is that Iran and the Shia militia in Iraq, and actually Iraqi government forces, knowing that the caliphate was about to fall, have turned their attention against the Kurds, who want to be independent from the Baghdad government, which is dominated by the Ayatollahs from Iran, and they want to be safe from Iran, too. Now the Baghdad government has just taken Kirkuk, a vital oil city in Iraq, and there are reports that that the Shia militias and regular Iraqi forces are now about to try and take Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. So I'm afraid that despite the president's rhetoric in his speech last Friday, there's every prospect that that Iran is just going to ignore what he said and try and take advantage of the fact we haven't been focused on Kurdistan, which the Kurds have been great friends of the United States over the years. They're going to try to make them subject once again to Baghdad. And if they do, it will be a bitter and deadly civil war. But if we're not supportive of the Kurds, they're in trouble. There's no question about it.
What does support look like? Obviously, you just mentioned all that they've contributed here. Is there any hope of stability as long as Iran is pulling strings in Baghdad and what we're seeing in Kirkuk continues to happen?
No, I think the safety of the United States depends on the Ayatollahs being overthrown. I've believed that ever since the Ayatollah Khomeini took over in 1979. But in the near term, I think we need to provide the Kurds with the armor and artillery that, ironically, we've provided the regular military forces of the Baghdad Iraqi government and the Shia militias. So the Kurds are now being attacked with American weapons. Our enemies, the surrogates of Iran, using American weapons, are now attacking American friends in the region who don't have those weapons.
Let's talk a little bit about the big picture of U.S. diplomacy. And in particular, I want to get your expert insights on this back and forth that's been going on in the press for the past couple of weeks about the president and the secretary of state. And whether someone called the other a moron is probably not the biggest issue here. But what do you know right now is their relationship? And what is the consequence of a president and a secretary of state butting heads, if in fact that's happening, whether it's over policy or personality differences?
Well, you know, there's no more important relationship for a Secretary of State than with the president. Dean Acheson, who was one of our country's most successful Secretaries of State for President Harry Truman, once said that the reason he and Truman worked so well together as a team was that neither one of them ever forgot who was president, which is I think pretty good advice. It's not like another cabinet position. Foreign policy is so critical to the success of any presidency, and defense, national security as a whole, that the president's going to be deeply involved in every foreign policy decision of any consequence. So if the relationship between a Secretary of State and the president is broken, this has serious implications for the country. And, of course, the only two people who can really tell you the answer to that question now are the president and Secretary Tillerson, but they've got to live with the relationship, and if it's working, then I'm sure it'll continue. If it's not working, then it either needs to be fixed quickly. People have talked about Vice President Pence intervening to try and help smooth things out, or they've got to come to some other decision. But it's not something that you can let drift on and paralyze our decision making. It's just too important. A combination, not to have both ends of it working effectively.
Real quick follow-up, there's also a debate about the president nominating lower-level people inside the State Department. Trump says in a lot of cases, including the State Department, those don't need to be filled. Others say it's critical to providing the necessary support, particularly if you have good people there. You've served as an Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, so talk about the structure and whether this is just bloated bureaucracy that doesn't need to be filled, or we're missing out on some key personnel here.
Well, I've been at the U.S. Agency for International Development. I've been an assistant secretary. I've been an undersecretary. I've been U.N. ambassador. And I have to say, my view is the only way a president really gets effective control over the State Department or any other cabinet department in Washington is by getting his political appointees into these senior posts throughout the bureaucracy, because the bureaucracy is like a big aircraft carrier. The way it was sailing when the president took office on January the 20th is the direction it's going to sail in until somebody says, turn it around. And if you don't have people to do that, your ability to turn it around is greatly reduced. I think that harms the president ultimately.
Mr. Ambassador, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you, sir, very much for your time.
Glad to be with you.
Former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, now with the American Enterprise Institute. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.